This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Like the beep, beep, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of a stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day.
That's Fred Astaire singing one of the 1,000 great song lyrics collected in the new book Reading Lyrics. It focuses on song lyrics from shows, movies, and pre-rock pop. My guests are the editors of Reading Lyrics, Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb. Kimball is a music theater expert who has also edited collections of the complete lyrics of Cole Porter, Ira Gershwin, and Lorenz Hart. Gottlieb is the former editor-in-chief of the Knopf Publishing Company and the former editor of the New Yorker magazine. Here's a song which Kimball and Gottlieb agree has one of the greatest lyrics. It was written in 1937 by lyricist Ira Gershwin with music by his brother George. This features Mel Torme.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. In time the Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made. But our love is here to stay.
Robert Kimball, Robert Gottlieb, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
The song that we just heard, the Gershwins' Our Love is Here to Stay, where does that fit in, Robert Kimball, in your world of lyrics?
The last song George Gershwin wrote, and maybe one of the greatest last songs written by any composer. And Ira finished the song after George died. George had only written the refrain.
And Robert Gottlieb, in terms of the writing and the rhymes, what do you find really special about that song?
Well, you know, one of the things that's said about Ira Gershwin is that his rhyming is very complicated and maybe over-clever. And here in this song is the proof that that was not necessarily or often so. Just go right to the beginning of the refrain in that it's very clear, our love is here to stay. The way that in the middle of the line that catches, and again, and in time may go, but oh my dear, and you hear that echo, but it's not a bang rhyme at the end of a line. It's just in there. And then it's all so simple. And then you get that wonderful image at the end of the Rockies and Gibraltar, which is the only fancy moment, and then it's gone. I just think it's a perfect lyric.
Now, I can't imagine where you started in trying to examine all the great lyrics of popular song from the turn of the century to 1975, how did you go about, first of all, surveying what they were and then figuring out which were worth including?
Well, I don't know how other anthologists work, but I work, and we worked, by diving in the middle without a plan. I happen to have a vast record library, and I just started picking up records and listening to hundreds, thousands of records, and supplementing that by looking at printed books, sheet music, etc. And I would gather together hundreds of songs that I thought were possible, and Bob would come over, and we'd sit and listen to them all, and we'd start drawing up lists.
Right.
And then it turned out to be by lyricist, because we weren't even sure it was going to be done that way when we started work on the book. It ended up a book about lyricists as much as a book about songs.
And I brought tons of songbooks over to his house. He probably wondered if he'd ever be free of them as we've cluttered his living room and worked together very, very well back and forth. But we've worked together for years.
Now, I know that choosing pop songs is not an empirical process where you could actually measure what is the better song. So did you have criteria other than what really struck you for inclusion
in
the book?
One criteria certainly is that songs that have endured. I mean, songs have a way of living, and how they live is a fascinating process. Sometimes they burn brightly in a way, and then they somehow pass from view for a time and come back. So there are many different avenues you have to explore to make this all come together. So I think that the fact that we were open and that we knew we were going to go through a very long process of learning, listening, thinking, reflecting, shaping was all part of it.
But finally, I think we felt that those songs that we were going to include were songs that could be sung today by cabaret singers or whoever. In other words, that they had a viable life in the now. They weren't just historical curiosities. And that applies to some of the very earliest songs, which maybe at this moment no one is singing. But they are songs we thought could be sung now and wouldn't be risible.
Let's play a song that I think works really well on a lot of levels. It's one of the songs that you both brought with you today. The song is These Foolish Things. And I think this is an example of a lyric that just works as good writing, but also it has really pleasing rhymes. Bob Gottlieb, would you talk about this song a little bit, why you chose it?
Well, it's always been one of my favorite songs, so that's a good reason to have chosen it. What we're going to hear today, Ella Fitzgerald singing it in a concert version. And by the way, people say that Ella scants words. You can hear that, again, that is not true. She is right on top of the words and their meaning. You have no feeling that she's sacrificing them to the jazzy aspects of
it. But the voice is so beautiful that that's what people are responding to. The sheer beauty and glory of the voice is so great that we often forget that she's fine on words.
This is also one of the not many examples of a first-rate British song, because this was written in England. By three people, of whom the key one for the lyric is a man named Eric Maschwitz, although when it was published, he didn't use that name. He used the name, what is it, Marvel?
Holt Marvel?
He used the name Holt Marvel.
He used other names, too.
He had a prodigious career in England. He wrote operetta, he wrote musicals, he wrote reviews, he wrote books. He's a very interesting person. But this song has prevailed, and it's sung by everybody.
When you point out in your book, you wrote the screenplay for Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, why don't we hear These Foolish Things sung in concert by Ella Fitzgerald?
A cigarette that bears a lipstick traces, an airline ticket to romantic places. And still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you. A tinkling piano in the next apartment. Those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant. A fairground's pain you came, you saw, you conquered me. When you did that to me, I knew somehow it had to be. The winds of March that made my heart a dancer, a telephone that rings, but who's to answer? Oh, how the ghost of you clings. These foolish things remind me of you.
That's Ella Fitzgerald in concert singing These Foolish Things, and one of the many lyrics included in the new book, Reading Lyrics, which is edited by Robert Gottlieb, former editor-in-chief of Knopf, and Robert Kimball, who's an expert on music theater and has edited several books on lyrics and composers. Do we all like the rhyme of the piano in the next apartment that told me what my heart meant?
I like it.
It's great.
Yeah. It's so unexpected. And this song leads to all those other songs like Thanks for the Memories,
yes.
That also are nostalgic about
when they're list, they're list songs where there's like a list of things that you're thankful for or that remind you of something.
Right.
And I think that list form is a whole genre of of song. Robert Gottlieb, you've edited, published many books of poetry.
For sure.
I mean, you're the former editor-in-chief at Knopf.
Yeah.
And your publishing company put out many, many books of poetry.
And still does.
It still does, and I'm sure you've read much poetry over the years. How do you think of lyrics as compared? How do you judge lyrics differently than you judge poetry?
Well, it's very, very complicated because a lyric is half of a work of art. Or half of a non-work of art, depending on what the song is. And you can read it and speak it separately, and yet you know that something is not there that is intrinsic to it, whereas a poem obviously stands by itself. And you are very affected when you read a lyric by whether you know the tune or not. It's a completely different reading experience, and that's why it's so hard to judge these things. Because there are certain songs we all know that we were born knowing them. And how do you forget the music to Night and Day? You can't. You can't read Night and Day, You Are the One, without hearing Cole Porter.
My guests are Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb, editors of the new book Reading Lyrics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb edited the new book Reading Lyrics, a collection of 1,000 great lyrics written between 1900 and 1975. I think that a lot of people used to read rhyming poetry, and very few people read rhyming poetry or write rhyming poetry anymore. But I think song lyrics have given us our fix of rhymes, that we get our rhymes through songs or through rap, depending on what it is that you listen to. Do you agree with that?
I think that those of us who grew up with the classic songs, which is most of the century, definitely are affected by rhyme that way and hear rhyme because of that. Whereas, as you say, in the 19th century, people who grew up on Longfellow, Paul Revere has rhymes, you know. So, but it is songs, I think, that give us our sense of rhyme. And that's why our ears spasm when we hear bad rhymes or fake rhymes. It's just wrong. We still get rhymes in country music. You know, it's one of the reasons I think country music is still so successful.
I think there's certain expectations that you bring to a kind of classic American popular song. One is that there'll be a verse. There's a kind of setup before the real melody begins. And the other is that there'll be a bridge, that after you hear the real melody sung through a couple of times, there's going to maybe be a key change, there's going to be a melodic change, you're going to go into a different direction, and then you're going to have the pleasure of returning to the familiar direction that the song initially brought you in. Is that a fairly Is that like a 20th century phenomenon, that type of pattern for a song?
I can't speak about way, way back and in art songs to what extent they followed these very somewhat restricted patterns. Mm-hmm. But I think that's been fairly common in the songs, although you do have in theater songs some variation in that. You have extended numbers where the number is really a series of sections that don't follow that prescription, very often an opening chorus or a number that might lead out of a big scene. This is much more related to the kind of operetta-style song that was a big part of the European tradition that, of course, got incorporated into our American polyglot tradition in the 20s.
Yeah, in a lot of musical plays or musical comedies, you will find a song in which there's, let's say, a witty patter or a witty refrain, and then there'll be another like introduction to it, and then there'll be another. In other words, the chorus will come back and back and back after extended sections that are different.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of the there's a few African-American composers from the earlier part of the century that you include in the book, each of whom have written at least one song that most people will know, though few people will recognize their names. And I'm thinking of Harry Cremer, Cecil Mack, Shelton Brooks.
Sure. Shelton Brooks, of course, is known for a number of songs, but Some of These Days is considered one of the most important songs of the century by many.
And I think most of these lyricists got started in vaudeville acts, which is interesting. And I thought another interesting thing is that most of them, although they were African American, wrote for a lot of white performers as well as black performers. That the color line didn't stop them or stop them completely, anyways, from placing songs with famous white singers like Sophie Tucker.
Sophie was very special, and they all loved writing for her. And she was wonderfully supportive of the Afro American songwriters. They all loved her very much.
I thought maybe we could hear from one of the lyricists singing the song himself. And this is Shelton Brooks singing Some of These Days. And it was Sophie Tucker who had the big hit of this. But this is a recording he made at a 1940 concert in San Francisco as a benefit for ASCAP. And I think you can hear in his singing that he really is from vaudeville. So why don't we hear the lyricist Shelton Brooks singing his own song?
Some of these days, gonna make me high. Some of these days, gonna feel lonely. You gonna miss my hugging. You miss me kissing. You miss me, baby. When your daddy goes away, you feel kind of lonely. Hold me only. You know, honey, I let you have your way. When you leave me, I know it's gonna grieve me. You gonna miss your bald head, daddy. Some of these days. Yeah, let's sing.
What do you think about Robert Kimball, Robert Gottlieb listening to that?
Hearing the stride piano accompaniment.
And that's the lyricist at the piano,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you know, it's... you're right, he's a vaudeville person who had to get over. All these songwriting teams were vaudevillians, and they all performed their own material. And it was very important for them because they didn't get really great spots on the vaudeville bills across the country in those years. And they had to work their way up so that occasionally when they got to next to closing, that was pretty extraordinary. But yes, they were their own promoters of their songs, and this is a great song. What a neat performance.
Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb edited the new book, Reading Lyrics. They'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb, the editors of the new book, Reading Lyrics. The book collects 1,000 of the greatest lyrics from shows, movies, and pre-rock pop, and features short biographies of the lyricists. Robert Kimball also edited collections of the complete lyrics of Ira Gershwin, Lorenz Hart, and Cole Porter. He's the artistic advisor to the Ira Gershwin and Cole Porter estates. Robert Gottlieb is the former editor-in-chief of the Knopf Publishing Company and former editor of the New Yorker magazine. I'm interested in the music that you grew up with. What was the music that you first became aware of and that first got you interested in music? Robert Gottlieb?
The first song I remember focusing on, for what will be obvious reasons, is coming home from summer camp one year. I must have been 9 or 10. And the kids in my class were singing something called Mersey Dotes. And Ozzy Dotes and Little Lambsy Divey. Not in our book, actually. And then I thought, what is this? And I felt very left out and behind because I had been away and I didn't know what this was. And so I started listening to the radio. And then this was the period of songs like Blues in the Night came and Chattanooga Choo Choo. And those were songs that were my first real Point Siena, Your Branches Speak to Me of Love. These are the songs that were real to me when I was 10, 11.
I remember Sentimental Journey.
That's later.
Yes, this is a few years later. And that would have been the mid-40s. That was pretty early for me. But my experience is because my mother both played and sang with the theater. And early show experience, of course, was Annie Get Your Gun and hearing Ethel Merman perform. That was very exciting for me. And I came to know her later in life and remained a big admirer of hers all the way to the end.
Did either of you I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and there was this huge musical gap between what I was listening to as a child and what my parents were listening to. They wanted to listen to the station that played Perry Como. I wanted to listen to the station that played Elvis Presley. And there was a real musical war going on. Was there a musical conflict when you were coming of age with your parents?
No, it was quite the opposite.
Not at all. There was the same music that I felt. That was your experience, Drew?
Yeah. For instance, my mother played the piano, and she loved to sing, and we used to sing a lot. We sang a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan. She'd play, and I'd sing. But when Oklahoma opened in the early 40s, which is the first musical I really remember seeing, we bought all the sheet music, and we sang all those songs from Oklahoma. And that was the way people really were related to music then. As it's now become almost a cliche to say it. There was a piano in every middle-class home, and people played and sang together. And that's how we knew those songs. Yes, there was stuff on the air, but it was nothing like the way it is today.
Instead of having a garage band, you sat around the piano in the living room.
That's right. And even if you had a garage band, your mother wasn't going to be part of it, I believe, in your day.
Absolutely.
Unless your mother was a very special lady, right?
Yeah. Well, radio was important.
Radio
and
was
your
important.
Your hit parade, and it was
your
was
hit
a
parade
show we
was
listened
very
to.
Yeah.
And my parents always told me that they got married to I'm in the Mood for Love, which was a 1935 song. And so I always became drawn to that material because it meant something to them. So we were still connected musically.
Are any of the songs that you brought with you today songs that you remember from your childhood?
It's the Lovely.
Yes, I would say It's Still Lovely.
Makin' Whoopee.
Makin' Whoopee
certainly
would be a song that I remember. It was just this huge body of sheet music that sat on the piano bench. And as I say, both my parents loved music and performed, but my mother was especially, really loved it and taught it to me. When I was learning piano lessons, I also learned to plunk out occasionally a little simplified version of a pop song or a theater song. I mean, it was a great moment in our house when the songs from Carousel came to us. My mother just thought that were the greatest things we'd ever heard.
You mentioned Makin' Whoopee. Why don't we hear that? In fact, why don't we hear two versions of that? Because you were talking about how these songs have such a remarkable life and how they're changed depending on what era it is and who's singing it. So why don't we play the Eddie Cantor version, which you brought with you, and then hear that back-to-back with the Ray Charles version. Did Eddie Cantor have the first hit of this?
Yes, he was in the musical.
He introduced the song. It was from a show called Whoopee in 1928 by Walter Donaldson, the composer, and Gus Kahn, lyricist.
It was a Ziegfeld show. And then it became there was a wonderful filmed version of it also with Eddie Cantor. Really, the truest view we have of Ziegfeld shows comes from that movie of Whoopee. Yeah, and again, just this is a song that was written for Eddie Cantor. This is one of those situations in which songwriters wrote for a particular star and his delivery. And then you can see what it's like when somebody from a completely different not a vaudeville Ziegfeld background, but a much more contemporary R&B background, how he deals with it.
Let's hear it.
Another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee.
A lot of shoes, a lot of rice. Groom is nervous, he answers twice. It's really killing, the boy's so willing to make whoopee whoopee. Picture a little loveliness, yeah, down where the rose is clean. Picture that same sweet loveliness. See what a year can bring. I tell you, the boy's washing dishes, baby clothes. He's so ambitious, ooh, I tell you, he's so. It's really killing, the boy's so willing to make whoopee whoopee.
That's two versions of the Gus Kahn lyric, Makin' Whoopee. We heard Eddie Cantor, for whom the song is written, and then we heard from Ray Charles, one of the many lyrics included in the new book, Reading Lyrics. The two editors are my guest, Robert Kimball, who has edited several books of lyrics and is an expert on music theater, and Robert Gottlieb, the former editor-in-chief of Knopf, former editor of The New Yorker magazine. Well, that is one of the great don't mention sex, but it's about sex kind of lyrics.
Right.
find a nicer word to use than sex. And of course, you know, listening to that, you can't help but think, too, Pepsi for those who think young, because it's one of the many songs that eventually became an advertisement, a jingle. And I think people who love songs always feel so irritated when
and yet it's a prime source of income for the estates of these writers.
Yes.
Well, I've become much more philosophical about that over the years. And I hear songs.
Well, you handle the Ira Gershwin estate.
I do,
and
Cole Porter. And when I hear, well, we've made some mistakes. We allowed I've Got You Under My Skin to advertise a cleaning for a toilet bowl. I've Got You Under My Rim. That was one of our classic oversights. We managed to let that go by. Anything you guys want is fine with us. But I hear, yesterday I was listening to a commercial for the Harlem Globetrotters, and there was Sweet Georgia Brown. And a lot of people don't know that. It's a great song, Sweet Georgia Brown, and Maceo Pinkard. And you hear it with the Harlem Globetrotters. It's their theme song. So I suppose that, you know, the love nest was kept alive by Burns and Allen's radio show. So many of these songs are connected through commercials, and it's okay.
Have either of you tried your hand at writing lyrics?
Only for special occasions for friends. Sometimes somebody would want something written for an occasion. I used to write campaign lyrics for John Lindsay when I was his legislative assistant.
No.
They're pretty awful, but when he was a congressman, we would go up to New York together, and John and Mary Lindsay would sit on the Eastern Shuttle and laugh reading the Sunday Times while I was penning out a version of You're the Top that somehow extolled him above every other political figure since Abraham Lincoln.
Do you remember any of the lyrics?
Let's hope not.
I think I probably do. How could I forget such matchless greatness? No, they were for the occasion. Then I'd have to teach them to the campaign workers. And the Lindsays laughed a lot.
Robert Kimball, Robert Gottlieb, thank you both so much for talking with us about lyrics. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb edited the new book, Reading Lyrics, a collection of 1,000 great lyrics from shows, movies, and pre-rock pop. Coming up, we remember bass player Milt Hinton. This is Fresh Air.